Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are continuing with our mythology series. We are already into season four, Jen.
It's all happening.
The two-parter Tunguska Terma, which tonight or today we'll be talking just about Tunguska. I have a lot to say about this episode, Jen, and I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, let's hear the tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These were in response to our very fun and interesting conversation with Julie Eng, who was the one woman band behind the scenes extras on the season 10 and 11 DVDs and Blu-rays. And so thusly, Julie was on set most of the time and gave us so many interesting insights into the production of her little documentaries, as well as what was going on the set. And you folks obviously enjoyed hearing from Julie as well. And Ray Noel said, so excited with this discussion. Thank you, lovely ladies. I'm so psyched no one could talk to me and my host while listening. I literally would snap. My poor hubby. Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you, Ray Noel. Apologies to Ray Noel's husband. I'm glad you were so engrossed, Ray Noel. I mean, we were too. So we're here to provide the interesting content.
All of our spouses are here to put up with us. That's their job.
And
the ones that do are the keepers.
They totally are. So, you know, if you can find someone that will put up with you when you snap at them because you're listening to an interesting X-Files podcast, then that is definitely someone you want to keep around. We also had a couple of folks asking about the scene in Plus One, because we talked quite a bit about Plus One, and specifically the scene post, and then they had sex the first time, and specifically the moment when Mulder was rinsing his mouth. And
we talk about the good stuff on this podcast, folks.
We talk about we get to the heart of the matter is what we're doing. And and we didn't really get a chance to talk to Julie about that during the podcast, but thankfully Julie is here for us. She swooped into Twitter and answered the question. So thank you, Julie, for that. Julie said, it's a bit of a blur. We discussed. Yeah, I understand, Julie. I feel like that every week. Honestly, my only memory about this beat was that it was a fake bathroom set, and there was a question of whether water out of the tap was potable. These are like the sort of practical details we don't really think about when we're watching the episode.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're asking if it was scripted or if it was Duchovny, I'd guess the latter, i.e. Duchovny. Thank you, David. There was discussion of the nature of his smile in the mirror with Chris Carter, which was scripted, and the meaning behind it. And let's get into that in a little bit more detail, because Karen, otherwise known as Rain Knight, comes to us with the script details. Thank you, Karen. And she said, I only own two pages of the Plus One script, but there are very good two pages. Are they ever? And so she includes the lines when Scully and Mulder are in bed, when Scully says, maybe we'll be out of jobs. And Mulder says, what would we do? And I love these stage directions always. And the direction says, the question hangs there until Scully rolls over on her back, looking up at Mulder, Mulder looking down at her. And then Scully says, we'd think of something. Now, of course, we know. Oh, yeah, can I read this last stage direction? Camera drifting off them into the room where Scully's double stands in the shadows, watching what we can't.
Oh my God, that's so rude. I love that. That's so Chris Carter.
Watching what we can't.
We can't, guys. We can't. They're never going to let us. I just like that it's scripted that we can't.
Yeah, and that there's this allure. Look at the double watching what we can't.
I'm so jealous. I've never been jealous of a doppelganger.
It's so weird.
It is bizarre.
There was a bit of a discussion about the use of the difference between the line as scripted, which in which Scully says, we'd think of something, mm-hmm. and the line as shot, which was, we'll think of something.
I believe I responded to that one, correct?
You did respond to that. What was your response, Annie? Do share.
Well, I liked the way that it ended up in the show, because we'd think of something is more of a hypothetical. And we'll think of something, I thought, was more of a, this is going to happen. This is a promise. I like that change. I don't know. I would be very curious to know if that was a Jillian change. I'm going to say I doubt it, because as we've gone through, like, usually it's Jillian's not the one changing the script. Usually David's the one changing the script, or like, you know, anyone could have changed that on the set. And it's such it's such a tiny detail, but I think it really, really changes the implication behind that line. And I really like that they went with what they did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that, like, I obsess over these kinds of things. Like, verb tense to me, like, can say so much. And like, if you're not into that kind of thing, you'll be like, why are you obsessing over this? But yes, it actually does. There is a significant difference here.
You know what it reminds me of? And I feel like we talked about this before in Amor Fati at the end, when he says to her, you were my constant, my touchstone. And she looks at him and she switches the tense up and says, and you are mine. And that kind of brings it back into the present, which I really, really like. And it's so subtle. Maybe you pick up on it subconsciously. Maybe you don't pick up on it at all. But I think it's a really, really nice touch.
It's there. And we appreciate the differences. And it's so funny. I mean, those of us that know the episodes really well, when I love reading the scripts, because right away you can pick up on the differences from as shot, because, you know, some of these episodes, I pretty much know them by heart. And so when I'm reading the script, I'm like, wait, that's different.
Especially this scene, which I know every shipper in existence has seen like at least 200 times. We know this scene by heart. So yeah, any sort of tiny thing is going to stick out.
Yeah, exactly. Karen also supplied the other page that she has from the script with Scully's arm draped over Mulder, which is interesting. I mean, this is all stage directions. love the way it's written. I mean, geez, Chris. Mulder and Scully lie asleep face up, Scully's arm draped over Mulder's torso in a way that suggests dot, dot, dot. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Chris.
Oh, my God. We're not even going to see this. This is in the script. That is what's so funny about this. It's like a joke. It's like a giant joke.
Just from him to him or something like that. I find it hilarious.
Who knows? We know.
Just loves it. When Mulder's eyes come open and he stares past camera for a few moments, thinking of what? And then he peels Scully's arm off himself and slips out of bed. And then he goes to the sink, thinking hard about something. After a moment, he lifts his head, looks in the mirror, staring long and hard at himself, until he smiles bigly.
I love this because this is such a Trumpism. It's like a joke, making fun of this sort of Trumpy language that they were all, we were all unfortunately entrenched in at the time of the revival, which I think is pretty funny. But you know what's interesting, too, about that stage direction is the fact that, like Julie was talking about, there were some decisions that were made last minute on the set. Like, they can't have Scully's arm over him because then you would be clued into the fact that she's naked, and they didn't want to clue in yet. And so they had to change that, which I really liked. I liked the way they did that. It would have been nice. It would have been nice to see her arm over his chest. But I get why they would have preferred that reveal. They like to mess with us. So, but I think that's
interesting. Nice to know it's nice to know the intention is there. I mean, to me, reading these kind of script directions, I'm inclined to think of it as canon personally, just because, especially when it's written by Chris Carter, because it's like, the intention was there for it to have been shot. I know that technically it never made it to the screen, but if it's in the script, to me, I'll call it canon. That's good enough for me.
Yeah, I think that's a gray area for me, because for me, canon is what we see on screen. But I do think that, like you said, script goes a long way in terms of intent. And while it isn't canon that she put her hand over her arm over his chest, we can assume that she did at some point because of the intent, you know? And so that's kind of how I can, you know, line up canon with headcanon in this case.
I like that. That's fair. Yeah, it's all about the intent of the scene.
Exactly.
Julie responded to, thanks again, Julie, for responding and adding even more deliciousness to these details. Julie responded to those script bits and mentioned specifically how that script page shows the Trumpian term bigly. More interesting to me personally was Chris Carter and David Duchovny debate over what the bigly smile is supposed to mean. I tried to convey that intent when David Duchovny says in behind the scenes, it's not about the sex. The smile is not about the conquest of getting laid. He toned the smile down to being less bigly. A collaboration over every character beat for this actor, Hooks, it's the director, and Chris Carter, which is why it was such a highlight. So that's really interesting to me that David's always like, you know, looking out for what's right for the character.
Yep.
And the story, which I appreciate. I mean, I know everyone is, but he's always got great observations, I think, and they obviously listen to him.
Yeah.
And this idea of like toning down the smile a little bit so it's not less about like, woohoo, I had sex.
It's the right call.
And more about like, oh, wasn't that nice? So, total right call. I love that. And you know what? I love the fact that Chris Carter is not so in love with his own script that he needs everything to stay exactly the way he wrote it. Because obviously, when he wrote it, he was very big on the bigly concept, probably. But he was willing to be challenged on that. And I think that's great.
You know, the bigly thing kind of strikes me more as him amusing himself as he's writing.
Yeah.
I think really a lot of screenwriters do those sorts of things. So, and to your point, I do think that he is very open and trusting for the most part of his actors and the people around him. And obviously there are some things Chris Carter will not be swayed upon, but some of these things are, and the shows are, I think, better for them. So
absolutely. I think it's great.
Yeah.
Karen adds an interesting point. Having seen a few scripts in her day, she says it seems that Chris Carter's revival scripts don't offer a ton of written direction in the scripts themselves like his older scripts did. I wonder if that was because he had planned on directing most of them himself. Interesting question, Karen. And maybe he did. Maybe his style had changed a little bit for some reason. I don't know, but that's a very interesting question and interesting observation.
As much as I love Chris Carter, can I say that I'm really glad that he didn't?
Yeah, no, it's for the best, right?
Yeah, I think so.
For the best. I mean, it was great the way they did it with so many of the writers directing their own episodes in the revival. I loved that. Like, you know, guys like Darren Morgan that we had never seen direct before did an amazing job. And other, you know, other guys that had acquired directing experience after leaving the X-Files were able to come back and apply that and do amazing jobs on the episodes they wrote, which is really fun to watch. So I like that.
Yeah.
Karen also added that indeed she has archived the posts from Ghoulie.net on her website. So that is where that came from, because we were aware that it had been archived somewhere. I don't think Julie knew that. And so she was quite delighted to find out that it was there, at least the bits that that could be scooped up. So thanks to Karen for that. And thanks to Karen for supplying the awesome script passages, as always. Monica File Fan said major props to Julie for coexisting around DD and GA and still alive and thriving to give us all the juicy deets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The plus one behind the scenes was amazing to hear. And should they kiss? In the words of Mulder, the answer is yes. Right. Erica Deb mentioned, because this was in response when we were talking more about the Scully effect, which was one of the great documentaries that Julie did. I love when Annie said how this show changed the way people feel about themselves, because I think it's so true. The X-Files and Scully specifically were such a huge part of very formative years of my life. I didn't become the marine biologist that I thought I would become. I'm terrible at science, it turns out. But I think Scully definitely influenced the person I am today. There's no way to know how much of my life changed because of that show, but either way, it's a huge part of who I am. Thanks, Erica. Great story. And yeah, reflective, I think, of a lot of folks' experience. I'm almost kind of a little envious of people who watched The X-Files when they were a little younger than I was. I didn't start watching it until I was in my 20s. And so I was kind of formed.
You're already there.
It was too late for me to dream about becoming a marine biologist. I mean, I think it probably did affect me, of course, but I think it would have had, it always has a more significant effect when you watch things when you're younger.
Yeah, definitely.
Looking to make your way in the world. I was kind of, you know, I was already married, and even though I've changed a lot since then, thank goodness, I had already formed a lot of my identity. So I'm always really interested in hearing folks that have had that kind of experience with The X-Files and how it affected them, whether they were watching it when it originally aired or watching it later on, if they had the chance to do it when they were a little bit younger. So very interesting. Thanks for that story, Erica. Pamela Stafford said, great interview, because I am also a Trekkie. I want to make my comment that Discovery is probably on the cutting edge of inclusivity in film and television. Great point, Pamela. That came up because Julie's also doing behind the scenes documentaries for Star Trek Discovery. And I basically just prompted her to talk about that so I could have a story to tell my husband, because he is such a big fan of that show. And I just wanted to pick up a tidbit for him. But I'm glad that Pamela enjoyed it as well. And Kathy G said, another fantastic interview. I loved hearing Julie's unique perspective. I'm forever grateful for the amazing work she did on the revival special features. Absolutely, Kathy. So are we. And we'll have those forever. And they are so great. This is a bit of a story that came out of our conversation with Julie, but also was going to apply to our conversation tonight. We talked about it during our conversation with Julie because we were talking specifically about a scene in that was being shot for Mulder and Scully Meet the Were-Monster. Is that the title? I've kind of forgotten for a second. That's the title,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I believe so.
That's the title. I just had this like blank, like what order those words go in. It's been a long day. And we were recalling Kim Manners as director having once been famed for saying the phrase "rock from Mars," and that's still being used even at that time in the shooting of The X-Files. And so Mia, I love Mia's Twitter handle, which is Scully's Cardigan. Mia says, now shedding half a tear reading about "rock from Mars." And thanks, Mia, for hooking us up with a link to a Tumblr post that does a nice job of telling that story. And let me grab it here. It's from the Tumblr. Which Tumblr user is that? X-Files Behind the Scenes is the Tumblr URL for this particular tale. And the tale goes thusly. It's from this story is from The Official Guide to the X-Files, Volume 3. Brief story, but lovely. Kim Manners was trying, this was during, by the way, just was during the filming of Tunguska, so thusly the connection with tonight's episode. Kim Manners was trying to remind us what we were dealing with was from outer space, and we were treating it too casually. So right before we would shoot, he'd yell, "Rock from Mars!" And that became our running joke from that point on. Every time we needed to get it up for a scene, Kim would yell, "Rock from Mars!" And that would be his way of kind of sparking us into life again when we were just too exhausted. I love that story. And I love the fact that it's a phrase that he used once, but it's just, it had so much impact. And they found it so amusing that it just caught on, not just with Kim Manners and
with everybody,
his time at the X-Files, but yeah, with everyone involved with the X-Files, even after we sadly lost Kim Manners, his phrase and the the meaning behind it lived on, which I love. And it is, it's always a little sad when we think about the loss of Kim Manners and the genius that he was. But that is a great story.
Those are the best kinds of little inside jokes, are the ones that just sort of naturally occur like that. Like, you know,
yeah, right?
And pick up over the years. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if David and Jillian like still use that or respond to it or joke about it on their own, whatever projects they're working on, you know?
That's right. Sometimes you just, and it's just a shorthand, right? Sometimes you just need that kind of little reminder. Rock from Mars. Oh, yeah. Like, okay, I get what you're saying.
Like how she's like, get it up. Every time we needed to get it up. Yeah, Rock from Mars. There we go.
I love it. That's great. And so it did kind of come up briefly because we were talking about the shooting of that scene in Weremonster. And it nicely segues into tonight's episode as well. So thanks for that. For that link, Mia, that's much appreciated. And thanks to everyone for your really interesting responses and insights to our interview with Julie Eng. We appreciate hearing from you on Twitter anytime at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. Tunguska.
Woohoo!
Season 4, episode 8.
Yeah.
Name comes from the, region in Russia where this quote-unquote UFO, or we don't know what it was, crashed.
Something,
to
something, yeah.
They say, and it's interesting because Mulder says that it was like the biggest event, the biggest like cosmic event like ever or something like that. He says something pretty intense, which I think
it was like this huge explosion that this thing from the sky caused.
Yeah, and it's funny because prior to the X-Files, I had never heard of it, which kind of is very X-Files-y in itself. Like, you know, like they were unable to find any evidence of anything, and then it got swept under the rug in true X-Files fashion, which is kind of creepy and appropriate.
I for some reason had heard of it. I think I saw like, I want to say a Reader's Digest article many years ago.
That tracks.
So this was kind of like, I don't know, what was it about the 80s and 90s? We were so obsessed with unsolved phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And that, so I had heard of Tunguska in passing. I can't remember if I like immediately recognized the title for that reason, being all like, ooh, Tunguska. I don't think I had. But when he talked about what it actually was, I'm like, oh, that's that thing with a banana. So, yeah, it's a very cool story. And you know, it's a true story as Mulder tells it.
Yeah, I like that. I like when they do that. And I always appreciate when we can sort of figure out where the title comes from, because I know a lot of the time we're like, hey, what does this mean? Let's just come up with some shit. This is pretty clear, and I enjoy that. So
thank you. Thank you, Pierce Carter and Frank Spotnitz, for making a title that we actually understand.
Yeah, I personally love this two-parter. I know you and I have talked about this before. This is not one of your favorites, correct?
It's like, it's okay. I have just really, I have varying and mixed feelings about it, but I don't love it the way you do.
Okay. I love all the mythology in season 4, and I know you probably don't. Like, I feel like season 4 is kind of where the mythology starts to fall apart for you. But for me, I think it's when the mythology starts to get, like, more interesting and more different and more unusual. Yes, more frustrating. I'll agree, and we'll get to that. But I think more than anything, I love the way this episode makes me feel, because it's like, it feels like peak X-Files. Like, the aesthetic is beautiful. They both, like, look amazing. Their acting is on point. Jillian in particular, like, this is her best season, in my opinion. Everything about the X-Files that I adore is in this episode. So I have nothing but good things to say about it, especially in terms of a mythology episode, which I know a lot of the time we don't really have a lot of. I don't want to say we don't have a lot of things, good things to say, but that's not true. But we usually have like lots of things to bitch about. And I'm not really, I'm not really there for this. This is one of my favorites. But yeah, you've mixed feelings, I know.
Yeah, I remembered liking it more than I actually do now. I don't know why. I mean, I don't dislike it. It originally aired on my birthday. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Nice.
It originally aired on my birthday in 1996, November 24th. Little tidbit, I got an X-Files episode on my birthday in 1995 and 1996 because that was where the years where it switched from Friday to Sunday.
Oh, you're lucky. I don't have any.
And 1996 was a leap year.
I don't have any. I never
got
none. I got none.
Sad.
December. So I'm like a very close to Christmas birthday, so I never got anything.
Right. Yeah. No. My birthday is in Sweeps Month, mm-hmm. so I would often get mythology episodes on or around my birthday. The 1995 episode I had for my birthday was Nisei. So,
oh, man.
Happy birthday to me. I've had some great episodes on my birthdays.
Nice job.
And I love the fact that there are baby files out there. And their special X-Files episode is the one that aired closest to the day they were born. And I love that. I love that there's like a very sort of special episode for them, because that's like their literal birthday episode. Whereas I was turning 28 when Tunguska was aired.
Oh, my God.
Aired.
Yeah, that's crazy. I kind of love that. And
only
they
have that. Just a little
side
trip there.
Yeah, only they have that luxury. We are too old.
Yeah. Definitely. So, I could have been giving birth at that point, but I wasn't. Anyway,
well, let's jump right in.
That was a little side. I got a little off track there, a tiny bit, but I think that's one of the reasons maybe why I remember liking Tunguska more than I do, because I was like, "Woohoo! Happy birthday to me, Tunguska!"
Well, there you
go.
And
I mean, it's good. I mean, I certainly like it better than I always welcome the mythology episodes. You know, after having had, you know, our standalone episodes for a while, just because those tend to be a bit of a mixed bag. And the mythology is always like, something interesting is happening, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
But when I compare it with other mythology episodes, I don't love it as much. I think it just comes down to a couple of things, but I think it's largely just because I feel like around this time, starting in season 3, the mythology kind of branches off, because we have the whole black oil thing. But then we also still have episodes that focus more on things like the alien human hybrids, the alien bounty hunter, Scully's chip, abductions. There's that aspect of the mythology, and that's the stuff I'm very into. The ones that the episodes that tend to focus on the black oil don't tend to have those other elements present. It just tends to be more about the black oil and maybe one or two factors around that. And so it's just not about the aspects of the mythology that I personally find as interesting, because I was very into sort of UFO lore and that kind of thing. So,
well, and at this point, they were,
I don't love it.
They were like deviating from that overall.
They were deviating, which is, you know, probably a good thing.
I mean, yeah, it was just continuing to sort of change and evolve to try and keep things fresh and different.
Yeah.
And
that's fair enough.
All of your points, I think, are valid. I don't love this episode because of the black oil. Like, I love this episode because of the interactions that the characters have. I think that there's some really great Krycek Mulder stuff. I think there's some great Skinner stuff. I think there's great Mulder Scully stuff. There's some really good CSM stuff. Like, I think that it's all the stuff like that that I really like. Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a very nice array of characters here. I definitely agree with that. It's very solid in that regard. I feel like there's not, maybe Scully and Mulder are a little passive in this episode as well. We'll get into all of this. A lot is kind of, I just feel like a lot is handed to them. And to me, that's less interesting than them.
Well, I mean, to be fair,
that's
part of the plot line in terms of them getting led and manipulated. And I feel like that is a great deal of what they do, is they're handed things and then they
just
follow.
Feels like that's all that happens. I don't know.
I disagree, but we will get into
that's
it.
Fair.
Let's jump right in here. Okay?
Let's get into it and then we're going to hash this up.
We are 30 minutes into this podcast, Jen, and we need to start episode. Please.
Well, we've covered a lot of aspects of it already.
It's true. So we'll start out.
Zip on through. We'll be done this in 5 minutes.
No. We start out with Scully in chambers. This is one of the most famous, greatest Scully scenes that we ever get. And it's in media res, so we don't really kind of know what's going on. It's just very tense. And I wanted to point out, I mean, everybody knows, you can talk about her speech and everything in a moment, because I know you want to, but the choice for this scene to be the cold open, I find a very interesting choice, because, I mean, it's not typical for the X-Files to do something like this. Mm. I mean, I would expect them to do the Gulag or even like Mulder in Tunguska or something like that, more action related, like kind of something about the black oil, something kind of more like, oh, ooh, what's going to happen in this episode? But no, we get Scully being badass. And I mean, there's really no reason for it. There's no reason for this choice. Like, we didn't need to see this scene up top, right? Like, there's no story narrative purpose for it. So the only conclusion that I could come to is that this is quite obviously the best scene in the episode. And they were like, we got to start with this shit because we want to draw people right in. And I mean, I get it. I love the fact that you are watching this and you're like, oh, what kind of serious shit has Mulder gotten himself into this time? Yeah. But Mulder's not even in this cold open. You know, it's all Scully. Yeah. Scully carries it. And it is a fantastic scene. And I just thought that the choice to use it for the cold open in media res, which they have done in media res before, so it's not like it's that's unique, but just I just think find that very fascinating, and I think it's a really good choice, and it makes this episode stand out.
It really does. It is a very interesting choice. I kind of, in my mind, I had kind of forgotten which scene was the cold open scene. I was in my head, I was thinking maybe it was the scene with the courier with the black oil being stopped at the airport, and I was starting to think of that as the cold open scene, and then I watch this and I'm like, oh, of course it's this. You're right, it is like not the obvious choice, but it's the awesome choice. It's a bold choice, really. I mean, it's a Senate committee hearing.
Right.
I mean, on paper that does not sound like the most exciting place to start a mythology, you know, top of the line episode. But it's so tense and so well acted and so well written and so well directed by the great Kim Manners that it's very engaging. And it just right from the start shows us where the stakes are. The stakes are so high. We're talking about Senate committee hearings here.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good point.
It really lays it out that there's some big shit about to go down. And and I love that. And of course, Julian is super awesome in it. That was one of my favorite Scully moments.
I remember that.
Was her testimony before this committee. I mean, she's got great lines. I am going to read some of my favorite lines from it. I still believe in this country, but I believe there are powerful men in this government who do not. Men who have no respect for the law and who flout it with impunity.
Damn,
I love
girl.
It. Flout it with impunity. I love it.
Love it.
And I love the fact that, and this focus on lawlessness, what I'm saying is there's a culture of lawlessness that has prevented me from doing my job. Men who are beyond prosecution and punishment. I like all of that because that is kind of a running theme through this episode. The idea that the men in the syndicate are beyond the reach of justice. So I like the fact that kind of established that in the opening scene too.
Yeah. And I mean, knowing that this is, you know, obviously comes later in the episode, she's basing this off, well, on her experience, but off of like the conversation that they have with Krycek. I mean, she's remembering what he said. And so in a way, like that has kind of gotten through to her, I think.
It has. Which I think is really, really, it's really stuck with her.
And Scully is always skeptical of Krycek, like throughout the entire series. Like, I don't remember ever there really being a moment where she is trusting of him or even to an extent of I need to use you for something the way Mulder can be. And so it's just interesting to note that that is clearly something that has gotten through to her. I mean, Krycek's not wrong. We'll get to that. But it's a great scene from him, too, because as much as we, you know, love to hate Krycek and we never really know where his true loyalties lie, he's spitting some mad facts. Like, you can't deny any of the things that he's saying. And Mulder and Scully can't either, which is why they end up here in her speech. I also wanted to point out, I love the juxtaposition between Scully being an absolute badass in this scene, dominating this scene, dominating this panel of white men, and the juxtaposition of that with this sort of casual misogyny of them referring to her as Ms. Scully.
Yeah.
Like, that rubs me so the wrong way. It is so condescending. Like, it's doctor or it's agent or it's any of these other titles that are not Ms. Scully. It's very like slapping you on the wrist. Sit down, lady. We don't need to hear from you. And I
just quiet down, little lady.
I don't know if is actually a product of, sorry, I'm getting wine poured to me while I'm doing my podcast,
well,
everyone. This is amazing. Speaking of casual misogyny, no, I'm just kidding. Not at all. This is the opposite of casual misogyny because my husband is treating me.
Yes, lovely.
But anyway, I think, I don't know if that's intentional in terms of the script trying to point that out, because I know they do that constantly on this show. Like, they have moments where Scully is faced with this misogyny and then she gets to sort of respond to it. It's not, it's not like, you know, like accidental 90s misogyny. It's purposeful. And so I'm wondering in this scene if it's purposeful. That's kind of my question.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the fact that it, I mean, it rubs you and I both the same way, the wrong way, and I think other viewers have seen it that way, especially those of us who are female and have experienced this sort of thing on a daily basis. We are maybe a little more sensitive to it. Whether if it wasn't the intention, it certainly came across anyway as this kind of casual misogyny and giving Scully a chance just to kind of show them exactly how badass she is and exactly how wrong they are. I love the way she's standing up to authority in this scene, because, I mean, she's come a long way from Scully of season one, who was still very deferential to authority. She's laying it all out there. She's totally on board with all of this, and she is speaking up for herself and for Mulder's cause. And she's not afraid of those old white men. She's telling them what's what, and I love it.
Well, and this is, again, why I really enjoy season four, season five mythology, and even late mythology, because Scully, it's different watching Scully. I find her more enjoyable to watch when she's sort of become season four Scully. Like, that, to me, is like, that's my favorite version of her to watch. Not that I don't have any problem with her in those other seasons, because she's evolving, she's growing as a character, but she's just so different at this point that it affects my enjoyment of the mythology to a greater degree, and so I just wanted to point that out. But
a fair point, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll obviously get back to this scene because it will show up later. But let's move on to the actual plot here, as much as we can get into this, Jen, because it is quite convoluted. This diplomatic pouch. Let's talk about the pouch, as Krychek says. Let's follow the pouch.
I've never heard the word pouch used so
many
times. Often.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard the word pouch so many times in 1 hour as I have watching this.
Well, and I love how particularly William B. Davis's Canadian accent comes out several times, because he's saying pooch. He's saying, "Where's the pooch? A boot?" Like, it comes out occasionally. I don't know if he's intending to do that, because I don't know if Smoky Man is supposed to be Canadian, but
I'm pretty sure he's not doing it on purpose.
His little accent comes through, and I think with pooch, it happened quite a bit in this episode.
Pooch. Diplomatic pooch. Yeah, God, yeah. No, I understand completely. Yep. William B. Davis, it happens when we're least expecting it sometimes.
It happens. I get it. So just to track this for the mythology, people who are taking notes, this is clearly, this rock has come from Russia, and then through Japan, and then through Honolulu, in case people are keeping track. So this is it is on American soil. It is in Hawaii.
Yes.
This is 10 days earlier. I think one of my favorite things about this scene, and this is very, very pre 9/11, but I just love how few fucks these TSA agents give. Like, he's like, "But do you know who I am?" And they're like, "We don't give a shit. Go through the doors, sir. Yeah. Go through the doors. I'm going to miss my flight." "Well, you better go through the doors pretty quickly then, shouldn't you?" It reminds me of when I'm talking to my kids and they are trying to fight with me on something. And I'm like, "You can keep fighting, but it's not going to change my mind. Go through the doors." Like, I just loved it. I loved it. I know they probably didn't even intend
that. Awesome.
But it made me laugh.
I love it. Consistency is so important when dealing with irate airline passengers and with children. So well done all the way around.
Very true. And I mean, they're just like, "Do you think we care that you're a diplomat? Go listen to what we're saying."
Yeah.
You think you're the only person in this airport with a connecting flight? No, sir, you are not.
Yeah. I do kind of like the way they're just not having it, because, you know, I have like a job where I deal with people all the day who maybe expect a lot that they may or may not always deserve. And it is always nice to have a fantasy that I would just tell them, you know, "Here's what you're going to do, and you're going to fucking do it." Yeah. And so I enjoyed that in a vicarious way.
Even to have it's a tiny bit of power, but it's a bit of power that you get to have. And that's it. That must be nice occasionally. I'm sure it must suck a lot of the time, but it must be nice occasionally.
Yeah, especially when someone comes in with this whole, I'm so very privileged, and it's like, no, you're not. No. So it was kind of, I did enjoy that.
Yeah. And this guy, I sometimes have to read my notes, Jen, because they just sometimes...
They're always good.
They amuse me. I just wrote, this guy is one dumb motherfucker, because basically, like, the guy's literally being like, no, there's he's essentially saying there's something poisonous in there. Don't open it. And he's like, what's this? I'm going to screw the tap up. What's this? And then, of course, it goes everywhere. And I'm like, oh, my God, you deserve to get black oil, bro, because you're so stupid. Oh, my God.
That was pretty idiotic. Like, what, biohazard? Smash.
Like, literally, like, if I hear the word biohazard, I'm backing away. Like,
yeah, I'm putting it down.
I'm not opening it up. I just have this fear. I always have this fear. Did you ever see that movie, The Rock? I feel like we've talked about this before with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. It's actually really good. It's a Michael Bay movie. Or Jerry Bruckheimer, one of those guys. But there's this like poison gas that comes in these little like round balls and like globules that if they drop and they hit the ground, they explode. And then like anyone in like a radius is going to get exposed to this horrifying gas that like melts your face, right? And so... I saw this movie probably when I was like, I don't know. I don't want to date myself, but I was fairly young. And it kind of haunted me because every time I hear like anything about like a biochemical weapon or biohazard or biodiserbad, I'm like, back away. That shit is bad news. And so when he's saying that this is a biohazard, I'm like, no, you don't even have gloves on, dude. Like, what are you doing? Anyway, I was just so sensitive to that when I was watching it.
Well, and these days, you know, we're so much more aware of PPE. It's such an everyday thing now. The idea of masks and gloves and all that kind of thing. The idea of hearing the word biohazard and not running for at least a pair of latex gloves is like so unthinkable now.
I just swear. I was like expecting like the freaking Keystone Cops theme to come up because this guy was so stupid. Anyway,
that's very stupid. I have to agree with you there.
Anyway, he's the guy knows what it is. He knows it's dangerous. He's going to get killed, obviously. He's pounding on the door. And I have to say that security at this airport's pretty lax because nobody is coming to this door. It actually pulled me out of it because it went on for so long and no one came to the door.
Yeah, it was a little too long, maybe.
Yeah, too long. I would have shortened that, or I would have at least had somebody come up to the door and like look through the window and be like, what the fuck? Because that would have been a really cool somebody is and they can't get in, like it's locked or something. It bumped me. I was like, why?
It did a little
he's yelling, he's screaming help like for a good 15 seconds and nobody is there. I'm like, no, you know there's an agent right outside, which then made me think like, oh, is this intentional? Is that person wanting them to get killed? Because this is the X-Files and you're of course gonna start thinking of all the different conspiratorial options. Anyway,
fair point. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on, shall we?
Yeah, interesting point.
So, one of my favorite scenes, Mulder and Scully in SWAT gear.
Oh,
yes,
my God.
Please.
Yes, please.
Never before and never again, everyone.
Yeah.
Here it is in Tunguska.
They look so good, especially Scully. Adorable, so tiny Scully wearing her tactical gear with all these burly men. And she looks awesome in
awesome
it.
With those guns and sneaking around. Oh, it's good stuff.
Love it. It's literally one of my favorite Scully outfits. I love her in it. And of course, you know, Mulder looks hot and everything, but of course hot in this. When I'm watching that episode, I'm taken out a little bit because the whole time all I can think is there is no freaking way they would have been on this tactical team because they are average field agents. I mean, I'm not an expert. Maybe some FBI folks can clue me in on this, but they are field agent investigators. They're not trained tactical agents. It makes no sense to me that they actually would have been front and center there.
That's actually a really good point that I didn't think about. I mean, I assume Mulder was in charge of this operation because he was the one getting all of the information. And so maybe it's the kind of thing where they are trained. I mean, they're trained. They're tactically trained, I'm sure, if they're FBI agents. It does, just because they don't do it all the time doesn't mean they can't do it.
Nah, fair.
So, and maybe this was the kind of thing that Mulder was like, you know, his typical, you know, stubborn self and was like, I want to handle this. And Skinner was like, fine, go ahead. You can put on the helmet. Go ahead. I can see this conversation happening. But
good. I like that.
You're
That's
right.
A great little scene right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked it too. You're right, but let's just go with it because
we got them in the awesome gear.
It
makes for more drama, obviously. It would have been a lot less exciting if they were like hanging back and like watching it on a screen or something. Yeah. So, you know, it's okay. It's great to see them in their tactical gear.
And
so
very well directed. I had to shout out to Kim Manners because I love the way this whole scene was directed. I thought it was very good. The action was very well choreographed, very exciting. I like that random dog just like running across the street. There was just some really cool stuff in this scene. I really liked it. And I did like, too, that they kind of kept it ambiguous as to who was. Like, you couldn't really tell which one was Scully, which one was Mulder. Because at the end of the day, like, they're a team. They're all a team. It doesn't really matter. I thought that was intentional and I liked it. Until the end when, you know, of course, we discover that it's Krycek in his little baseball cap. just love it. I have to say, besides the piece of exposition that he was liberated on the on a salvage hunt that I know we already have issues with, because this was literally just like the dumbest way to resurrect Krycek when he should have just been killed. But again, let's suspend our disbelief because we get Krycek back and I love Krycek. I know you're an but I do love Krycek. I get very excited.
Oh, no, I love Krycek. But I totally agree. This return of Krycek was... Lame.
Okay. But other than that bit of information, I think this scene in the truck with Krycek, Mulder, and Scully is probably my favorite Krycek scene of the series. I think it is such a good scene. Nick Lay does so good with what he's been given. He was given a lot, too. I mean, he has a lot to say. He has some of the most important lines to say. And he just did a great job. You can feel the tension, I think, between all of them, particularly Mulder and Krycek, which I know we're going to get some mail about, but you can feel it. It's good in this scene. And I think that Krycek's motivations are becoming a little more clear here. And maybe they've changed since what happened to him. He knows that Smoking Man was the one who tried to kill him and left him for dead. And he's now just like, hey, we want the same thing. I want to pull one over on CSM. You want to save the world? Let's work together. It's kind of that sort of thing. And even in the end, how we know that Krycek, we find out in the next episode that Krycek's sort of manipulating this entire thing, you buy it. Everything he's saying, you buy. And I think that's what makes a really good sort of master manipulator, which is what Krycek is. So I just think a really great scene with all three of them.
Yeah. It is a great scene. And yeah, we do actually get quite a lot of sort of clear exposition, which is a rare and wonderful thing in
well
a mythology
done exposition.
Episode.
Well done. Yeah. As opposed to the scene with Mulder and Scully in the truck talking about the 2-ton truck or whatever. And I'm like, really? Y'all didn't talk about this on the way out here? I hate scenes like that. Like, I know they have to do it. I get it. But it's so distracting. Anyway.
Yeah, I just kind of assume that like, maybe Mulder or Scully just arrived late and didn't get the update, and so they have to get
it
now.
No, but clearly Mulder knows it, and it's like they're there, they're in their gear, and Mulder's telling Scully what's happening now.
What were they doing while they're putting their gear on?
Exactly. And I know this is just TV, but it's just it's one of those TV things that really bothers me. And again, I am not. In the scene with Krycek, it's well done. It makes sense. All of the exposition coming out of Krycek makes absolute sense. They haven't seen him in over a year. So it's or over a year. It's been over a year, right? Well,
yeah, it's
half
a
year.
Yeah.
6 months.
Yeah. I mean, like if we're talking about sort of our time, in our timeline, it is like about a year since I think.
It's been a while.
We saw him at the end of
Apocrypha.
Yeah, it's a very natural conversation. It doesn't feel like it's like, and now I present to you facts of the mythology, which sometimes those conversations can kind of be, but no, it's just like it's a natural conversation. It's coming from a place of interesting sort of character moments in terms of we're learning Krycek's motivation, like you say. And he also kind of ropes in Mulder and Scully's motivation when he says, you know, the man who tried to kill me, also the man who was responsible for the death of your father to Mulder, your sister to Scully. He's kind of bringing, he's
making
just kind
personal.
Of roping them all in, making it personal, making it a personal conversation instead of just some kind of abstract, the syndicate conversation, which makes it more interesting and really, like you say, quite believable. And I think it's always hard to tell with Krycek. I think to some extent he believes it himself at that point. He's just such an ever-changing, slippery chameleon that he believes it anything about himself at any given moment, I think, and then just changes his mind as he goes. So at this point, I kind of believe him that that's his main motive is to get CSM, and their motives just happen to align at that moment. And Krycek's all about just finding people whose motives align with his.
Yeah.
And at that moment, Mulder and Scully's do, I think. So I enjoy that. I find it interesting. It is a great scene with the three of them, although sometimes I kind of feel like, is Scully just kind of sitting in the background wondering what she's doing there and like telling Mulder and Krycek they should get a room, because there's so much going on, it seems, between Krycek and Mulder, and Scully doesn't seem to be quite as involved, which is why I'm pleased at least to find out that later on in the episode, she seems to have kind of bought into it, because it's hard to tell how she feels during that scene itself.
Well, I don't know. I realize that you're distracted by your Mulder and Krycek love. I get it.
It's hard not to see it.
It is. Oh, and I agree with you, but
they're
right
there.
I think that Scully is very present in this scene, so I'll disagree with you with that. She's definitely there.
Fair enough.
She's being involved. We're seeing more of Mulder and Krycek because they're sort of you know, they're giving us their exposition here. Expositing,
more
is that a
about
verb?
About them, I don't know, but it is now.
I have made it a verb. But I think that like Scully's very much present and very much I keep going back to what you said about them being passive, and I just don't see that in this episode. I see that sometimes. I just don't.
That's fair.
They're on the case here.
They're on the case.
Even though they're being led, they're always being led. That's like the name of the game here.
It's not often that I watch Mulder and Scully and think, I could have probably resolved this case as effectively as they did, because I probably could have, because if I knew Krycek and he handed me all this information, or if I knew other informants and they handed me other information in a weird way, then I feel like I would have wound up in the same place they did. And I don't know if I should feel that way when I watch the X-Files.
I think you're not giving them enough credit. But we'll see.
Okay, fair enough.
I'll see if you feel the same way when we get to Terma, because I don't see that. I think that Mulder and Scully, with her expertise, solve a lot and move the plot forward
themselves.
I agree
with you, yeah. I agree that Terma definitely has a bit more going on in that regard. So I think this is just, I suppose this is, you know, because it's just a setup episode, it is hard to judge it on its own merits.
Okay. Well, I even disagree with you on that, but
Fair enough.
I think they do plenty in this episode, but we'll see. We'll see. I think it's really funny how Krycek says they make it up as they go along, because I always feel like that's very meta.
Oh my God. Honestly, isn't it?
Everyone
is
thinking
that.
Truth.
Yeah. These men, they make it up as they go along. I mean, is that not the mythology?
But that's life. It's so true to life. You know, I mean, people get mad about that, but that's kind of how this stuff works, guys.
Well, it is, but there's always a wish that it wasn't that way, but it obviously is.
Yeah, I mean, there is always that wish, but I at the end of the day, I feel like everything connects enough to make sense in terms of the way it's being changed and the way it's evolving as we go along. It's clear that what we're dealing with is a rock from Mars, which is pretty simple, you know, and it's something that is trying to that Krycek's trying to keep from Smoky Man, or you know, the plot is a simple plot told in a very convoluted, unnecessarily way, and I think that's a lot of the X-Files. I think and it's a storytelling choice, because they want you to be confused. They want you to have to put the pieces together. But at the end of the day, we got a rock from Mars that's got some black cancer in it. And that's all we need to know. You know, I mean, like, it's not as crazy as people think. Anyway, let's continue. So Krycek tells them about the pouch, the pooch, and which is going to have the rock from Mars. And we have this really kind of cool chase through the airport, which
oh my
really
God,
love.
Yes.
I love how Scully is your little legs. And she's like, Mulder's not even running hard because he's clearly letting Scully beat him. And we know in this very episode that the man can outrun a horse. So I always find that very distracting, but I still love it.
No, I don't find it distracting at all. I love it. I love every second of it. There's not that many, to my recollection, and I could well be wrong, but to me, I don't recall that many scenes where we actually get to see Gillian Anderson as Scully running all out like that. A lot of the times we just see her from the back. I think sometimes maybe it's a stunt double or something. Mm-hmm. But to see, this is definitely Gillian Anderson. She is definitely running all
out. This is a delight. It's a delight. I love it.
It's a delight. And it's really well shot. The whole chase through the airport is really well shot. Really, like, love the movement of the camera. I mean, literally, I watched that, like, 10-second clip of Mulder and Scully running over and over last night. I was watching this episode because I enjoy it so much. I'm going to have to GIF it and just enjoy that over
it's
and over.
It's fantastic. It's like, it's on par with what we talked about when we talked about Fight the Future, when Mulder's running and he kind of takes his jacket off and just throws it. Like, that's some good stuff. I could watch that on loop and do frequently. this is good stuff. This is good. Gillian running through the airport with her tiny little legs, holding her gun and her giant coat, her shoulder pads. Yes. And it's fantastic.
It's so Scully, and I love it.
Yes, yes. And another thing I love is about this joke, or about this scene, is Mulder's dumb, "What did you get for Halloween, Charlie Brown?" I don't know. He's like, how does he think of these things? Like, I get it.
Does that even make sense?
No, it totally does, because in the Halloween Charlie Brown, when he goes trick-or-treating, he looks in his bag and they go, "What do you get, Charlie Brown?" He goes, "A rock." And, like, that's the joke. And so when
Did you not get the joke? I didn't get the joke. Okay. I mean, I'm sure I've watched the Peanuts Halloween special, but it's been a long time.
Right. Well, all the kids get candy and Charlie Brown gets a rock.
Because I was a grown-ass woman when I watched this. I had forgotten all of that. So Charlie Brown actually gets a rock.
Yes, yes. It's actually a very good joke, but it makes me think, like, was Mulder thinking of the joke while he was, like, running through the airport? Or did he think of it on their walk back? He's like, oh, this is real good. This is a real good one. I'm going to say this to Krychek. He's going to be real impressed. Like, it's just, I get it. It's like one of those things that is like, okay, this feels very writer-y. Like, it is, it's a Mulder quip. It's definitely an in-character Mulder quip, but I think it's a little too much of a deep cut to be a workable joke.
So. It does feel a little writery. It's sort of, to me, it's on par with that insult he makes to Krychek in the first scene with him, where it's, what is it, something about being two drops short of being dry.
Your dipstick is too short, two drops dry of a dipstick. I don't know, something. It's very well delivered.
It's well delivered, but it's ridiculously convoluted, and I don't believe for a second that a normal human being would come up with that off the top of their head.
Right, right. I agree with that.
I see what you're saying. Like, it's a little too writery. This one is marginally better. At least now I get the joke. I didn't get the joke. I'm like, why? Wouldn't that be more like Christmas and a lump of coal? But now I totally get it. So it's a good joke. It's a bit like, okay, really?
Do you know what it makes me think of? And I this might delight some of our listeners. Have you watched the show Ted Lasso?
I haven't. I don't have that whole Apple Plus situation happening. Okay. I really need to get into it because I keep hearing how awesome Ted Lasso is.
Ted Lasso is fantastic, but it kind of reminds me of some of the jokes in Ted Lasso, which I think the writing on that show is brilliant. And you believe it because this character is just full of quips like that. Like, that's his character. Okay. But sometimes he'll say one that is just so good. It's so well thought out and funny and amazing that I'm like, a writer wrote that. Like, it's too good. Like, I don't, even though I believe that he's saying it because he's Ted Lasso and he's just full of these things, I still, it sometimes will take me out of it because I'm like, it was too good. It was too good to feel natural.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And while this isn't, I won't pretend that this is on the par of that because this is still just, you know, kind of a dumb joke. It does. It's too good in terms of, like, it's just too specific. It's too much of a deep cut. It's something that, like, I don't necessarily know Mulder would have in his arsenal.
Yeah. So, does he think about the Peanuts Halloween special that often?
Yeah. I don't know. It's just strange. We've talked about it for far too long. But anyway, I had to bring it up.
It's the little things that bug us. It bugged me. I have to say it to him. I'm like, what the fuck? But now at least I have some understanding of it. So I'm glad we did discuss it.
It doesn't bug me. It's one of those things where it takes me out a little bit, you know?
Fair enough, yeah.
So Mulder tells... I don't know what Scully's doing at this point. He sends her away with the rock, I guess. I love when he shows up at Skinner's apartment.
And with my God.
When you see Krychek, Skinner has this sigh. He's just kind of like, of course, here we are. And then you know that once Krychek gets in, Skinner's going to get in on it. And I love when he punches him and they have this moment. Because when's the last time Skinner saw Krychek? I was trying to remember, like, why is he punching Krychek? I mean, just in general, Krychek is a piece of shit.
Has he maybe not seen him since Ascension, when Krychek just kind of vanished from the FBI?
Well, he knew Krychek was involved in his shooting because, you know, Luis Cardinal shoots Skinner in Paperclip, I believe. Or was it
I mean,
one of those?
He knew that Krychek was up to some bad shit, but I'm not sure he had like
has
a personal
encounter
with
him. I think it's kind of a punch worth of several episodes of shit that he had coming. That's kind of what I said. Either
definitely.
Way, I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed everything about that scene. Shirtless Skinner just kind of doing up his pants as he's coming down the stairs. Let's just say I watched that one on a loop a couple of times as well.
I wrote this down. There's Dad Skinner and there's Daddy Skinner. Some of our Skinner fans will enjoy that. So
that is perfect.
This scene stars Daddy Skinner.
He is really great in that scene. He doesn't have a whole lot to do, especially at the beginning, but he just nails Skinner every time. Yeah. And it's like, is everyone going to punch Krychek during this episode? I mean, I start to feel a little tiny bit sorry for Krychek after a while. Mm-hmm. He's getting beat up constantly. What is with that? I mean, like, literally, as soon as Krychek appears on screen at the very beginning of the episode, the very first thing that happens, Mulder punches him right in the gut. People can't stop punching that guy. I mean, not that I object. I kind of want to punch him, too. So fair enough.
I did write on my notes, every time Krychek gets punched, an angel gets its wings.
There's a lot of blessed angels after this episode, for sure. Definitely. What do we think of Krychek's short haircut, by the way? By the by, I'm a fan, personally.
I am a fan, too. I think this is his best look.
I think it is, too. I agree. Not with the hat, but without the hat, he looks hot.
I do love it. I love season 4 on Krychek is just peak. So I appreciate it.
Nice.
So now we're at NASA. Let's go over to NASA and talk some science.
Let's go to NASA. Yes.
I love
science time.
Yeah. Speaking, you know, kind of referring back to our scene from earlier with the casual misogyny, Dr. Sachs is just absolutely opposite because he talks to Scully, looks at Scully like she's the expert, talks to her like she matters. She's the expert here. She knows what she's talking about. And I think that's very purposeful. And I loved it in this scene. Like, he'll look over at Mulder every once in a while to break up the scene because, you know, that's what actors need to do. But I loved that. So well done, Dr. Sachs. You deserve a round of applause.
Thank you. Restoring our faith in men everywhere.
Yes.
It's those little things, though, right? In terms of, like, who does he look at? Because those are things that certainly we as women notice. My husband still can't get over the fact that when we bought our car, I was doing all of the talking, literally, and the car salesman still addressed everything he said to Sandy.
Yeah.
So
this is the casual misogyny. People just assume, the man is here. He's going to take care of things. But no, clearly, Dr. Sachs has been around many different types of experts and scientists, and he knows what's up, and he gets extra points.
He's been around some women in STEM. He gets it. I love it. Thank you, Dr. Sachs.
I have to give a shout out to the actor Malcolm Stewart, just in case that was an acting decision, because we don't know.
Yeah.
Either way,
he does it well.
Either way, well done, Malcolm Stewart. And he deserves
a shout
out.
He's been in a few other episodes, I do believe. I didn't get into the details of it, but I had a very quick look at his IMDb, and he was also apparently in the pilot.
Oh,
and
nice. Another X-Files alum.
Two episodes that I can't recall now. But yes, he's been in a couple of... he was in 3. He was also in 3. Sorry.
Oh, that's probably why I have no idea. There we go. That
yeah, exactly. And he was in one other one that I can't recall. So he's one of our Vancouver standbys and does a solid job, which is probably why I keep inviting him back.
I wanted to bring up, obviously, a huge connection to, well, Fight the Future, but everything, that this carbon matches the same carbon found in a meteorite in Antarctica, which apparently...
Antarctica!
It definitely... I mean, it's Antarctica, but it definitely shows that this has been around for a very, very, very long time, mm-hmm. which kind of clues into where we get to in Fight the Future, which they were obviously filming at this same time. So this is something that they would have known while they were making season four. Just wanted to point that out. Yeah. I like that they're laying the groundwork for that, since we aren't really going to see it until Fight the Future. So,
yeah, it's... there's very much like I get a couple of Fight the Future vibes throughout this episode, like that line when Krycek is talking to Mulder and Scully and talks about the syndicate and says they're the engineers of the future. It's very much a Fight the Future kind of concept. Mm-hmm. So, I definitely enjoy that kind of Fight the Future vibe.
I know we talked about this before, but like season four and five and Fight the Future is kind of my favorite run of mythology, and I feel like it's kind of your like least favorite run of mythology.
Oh no, I wouldn't say it was my least favorite. It definitely gets worse, but
well, that's true.
It depends on the episode. Some of the episodes are my favorite, like mm-hmm. the Cancer arc. I adore mm-hmm. Fight the Future. I adore.
Yeah,
it's just there's a few that are not my favorites, and this might be one of them.
Okay, fair enough. I have to say, this scene where Krycek's out on the balcony and he's kind of handcuffed to it, and the guy, this doop-de-doop guy, I swear to God, another dumb motherfucker, walking out around on the porch, and he's like, or the patio, whatever you call it, the balcony, thank you, I can't think of the word, the lanai. He's out there and he's walking around and he's like,
the lanai.
Oh, is there somebody out here? Is there somebody out there? How the fuck did Krycek grab him? Without the dude seeing it, because he's just walking and suddenly like the hand comes into screen and like grabs his shirt and it's a see-through, it's bars. So it's like, how did he not see Krycek? I mean, I swear to God, like Smoking Man says wars have broken out over far less. Wars have broken out because of dumbass henchmen. I swear to God. Like, what is happening here?
Yeah, it's very, it's funny when I watch that scene, it always strikes me as a bit surprising the way Krycek seems so very enthusiastic about killing this guy, because it's not, to me, obviously self-defense. The guy does not seem to be remotely aware that Krycek is out there. Yeah. I feel like there was a decent chance he was going to turn around and go back into the apartment, but Krycek is keen to kill him.
Well,
I'm not
me,
totally sure why.
Yeah, I was wondering if, and this is possible, if maybe he was like seizing an opportunity to get himself back over the balcony, because he went over the balcony and then he was like, well, fuck, how am I gonna get back over? And so he's like, oh, this guy's gonna help me. And so he can pull him and kind of get himself back over and then kind of maybe accidentally killed him. I don't know. It's a stretch.
I don't know. That's as good an explanation as any, because I'm not quite clear on why he'd be so like keen to kill that guy.
I mean,
so,
it's unclear whether or not it was purposeful for him to kill him. I mean, he does.
Yeah.
He throws him over the ledge, but I mean, maybe it wasn't entirely on purpose. I don't know.
He throws him. Let me just, I just want to just reiterate that line. He throws him over the ledge, but maybe it wasn't entirely on purpose.
But he's like, he's simultaneously like trying to climb back over. And so maybe, maybe, but I don't know. You're right. It does seem like a strange choice. I don't understand. And besides, it's not like he leaves. He stays there.
It doesn't help him.
No. So it's like, what is his game here? He just likes killing people. Or maybe maybe he has a secret vendetta against this guy. Maybe this is like an entire fanfic. Like Krycek's like, that fucking guy. He slept with my girlfriend. He's dead.
I'm thinking of a backstory where they were secret lovers in the past. So that's going to be the way I'm going to go with that.
I like that. Okay, I will go with that too.
But I mean, it is necessary for that guy to fall off the balcony, because that is, of course, the trigger for much of the rest of the story.
Right,
so
right.
It's just the way it goes.
Right, right. Because if, you know, I mean, but that kind of just puts, I mean, you're right. The only reason that happened is so that this entire congressional hearing can happen and people are aware of it and all this, and it's like, wow, Krycek, like you really fucked that up, didn't you? I mean, was that even part of his plan? I mean, maybe it was, I don't know. This like I said, this plot is so convoluted that it's hard for me to sort of follow the threads in that way. But it does. You're right. It does kind of propel the action. So here it is.
It does. It's necessary to the plot. So we just kind of at some point, I think that you just got to throw up your hands and say it's Krycek being Krycek.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's his way.
There is a scene here where Mulder, and I don't know if I have the order right, where Mulder is calling Scully and telling her about the rock. Or no, they're talking about the rock. And he has
the rock from Mars.
The rock from Mars. He has a line that you've notated here, Jen.
Oh yeah.
The line is, go for it.
This was a conversation in the office actually. And Mulder's obviously been like following up. He's been talking to the State Department and getting some information from US customs officials about where the rock came from, blah, 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 blah. Which, first of all, I'm a little confused when Mulder says, which leads me to believe what's in this rock we intercepted are answers beyond the existence of extraterrestrial life, even beyond the conspiracy to cover up that existence. I'm like, what else is there in the X-Files?
I don't know, man.
Existence of extraterrestrial life, the cover up. I have no idea what else he could be referring to.
I don't either. I mean... I bumped on it too, Jen, because I was
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
This just sounds like maybe even a Mulder line that he misread and nobody caught it or something. Like, could that be possible? Because it does seem weird. Like, the only thing I could think of is that whole God thing that we come back to later. But that's, I mean, I don't think that's what's happening here, which is why this line stuck out to me too as very slightly annoying. But
it's like, how big does it have to get exactly? But it's a certain kind of style and a certain kind of pattern that we see throughout mythology episodes where there's some kind of vague allusion to this is bigger than anyone could imagine. Well, and just don't ask exactly what it is because you're never really going to find out, but it just sounds great at the time.
Well, and usually it's Mulder delivering that line, and it sort of leads into the next point I want to talk about, which is sort of Mulder getting kind of unhinged and going off on one of his rants or one of his crusades, and then Scully being the one to need to pull him back. Which she says in the office, what I'm worried about is you, Mulder, and how far you'll go and how far I can follow you. Now, Jen, I love that you put this in our outline because... Mm. I have a lot to say about this.
So do I. I'm glad you do, too. All right. Let me hear what you have to say.
Okay. Well, what I want to say, first of all, is it makes me think of I Want to Believe. Yeah? Okay. I have gone around and around with people who believe Scully is out of character, wishy-washy, not in character, very like off base in I Want to Believe when she says something very similar to Mulder. People will go so far as to say it's even cruel. And I always thought that it was in Scully's character to be this way with Mulder, to be worried about him, not necessarily you doing your job, Mulder, but you going above and beyond and finding yourself in this place that I cannot follow you. Yeah. And I think that the fact that we are getting this here, very, very pre-relationship, she's still worried about him and what this stuff does to him, and the fact that she is unable to follow him. It very much makes me think of that locker scene in I Want to Believe, and how in character it is for Scully to realize that Mulder has gone beyond his duty and has gone to this place that she cannot follow him. I love it. I love seeing it. I love it here. I love it in I Want to Believe. I think it shows character consistency, and it shows the divide between them that occurs time and time again. I think it's really, really well written, as opposed to that weird Mulder line that we just talked about. I think this is well written and well acted by Gillian, and Mulder's reaction to it I think is very telling. I think it's a great scene, and I'm glad that it's here.
Me too. I mean, we don't get much MSR in this episode, and so I'm happy to grab onto whatever tidbits we get. And this is quite a large tidbit.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's very consistent with Scully's character and very consistent with the nature of their relationship. I mean, she says variations on this numerous times throughout their relationship. You know, I love the fact that I think sometimes Scully can be perceived as just kind of this person who just blindly follows Mulder and has no sense of her own sort of identity, but that's so wrong. And this kind of scene really helps to hammer that home, that she is a woman who will set boundaries, mm-hmm. and will tell him that. And I appreciate that. That is what you got to do. You got to set your boundaries. You got to communicate them. She is showing us how it's done. I appreciate that. I like that about her. I like that about their relationship. The only thing that kind of throws me in that scene a little bit, as much as I love all that, I'm a little confused about what prompts it, because to me, Mulder doesn't seem to be particularly wackadoodle in this episode. I don't feel like he's like needing to be reined in to me. So I'm always a little confused about where this is coming from all of a sudden, aside from just kind of setting this up as a character moment.
Yeah, I agree with you there, because it does feel like Mulder's just got a Mulder. And but at the same time, part of me is like, well, those are the moments where she needs to sort of reel him in. And I agree with you. This particular moment didn't stand out to me as like, I want to believe where in, for example, where I think it was particularly necessary and motivated for her to rein him in.
It was very much set up appropriately in that one.
Yeah. And here it's a little kind of out of the blue, but I feel like it does feel like it's presented here as more of a character moment, as a, we're in season four, we're building up to Fight the Future, which we're writing currently. We need to start laying the groundwork for this stuff.
I can live with it.
And I can also live with it in the way that like Scully is maybe seeing things that maybe we don't, because she knows him more than we do.
I like that idea.
Yeah, like she's cluing in to maybe some signs that this is leading nowhere good.
Which, I mean, it isn't. She would be right about that.
Right.
I mean, he did wind up going a little crazy in terms of how far he was willing to go. And while to me, I don't see a lot of it at that point in the episode, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
She knows him better. Maybe she sees the signs.
Mm-hmm. And we know that this leads to a very, very, what we will find out, life-altering event for Mulder. Which we don't even know for sure he ever even tells Scully about. So, I mean, I'm sure he does, but we don't ever get to see it. So, it's one of those things, too, that she's trying to rein him in. And at the end of the day, she was probably right.
It's always good to establish that Scully is right.
Yes.
And that if Mulder would just listen to her, things would turn out much better for him on a regular basis. Always good to establish that. So that has value in itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm also kind of thinking, it's just kind of occurring to me as well, that sometimes in relationships, things simmer under the surface and they just come out at odd times.
Yeah.
That maybe it's not the most obvious moment for you to bring up that point of something that's been kind of in the back of your mind for a while. But maybe, I don't know, she's been ruminating on this as an issue for a while now, and it's just starting to kind of bother her, and it just comes out at random moments because it's just there under the surface and it troubles her. And so sometimes these things just happen. You just come out with things that don't necessarily have anything to do with what's happening at that moment, but it just comes out because it's something that's on your mind. So it can be as simple as that sometimes.
I agree. And that does, even though that takes a lot of mental gymnastics to get to, in a weird way, it makes it feel real because like you said, that is how real people behave. So I like it. I like that it is happening in the office, too. I really enjoy that.
Everything in the office is always awesome.
Yeah. So Jen, let's talk about this Marita Covarrubias scene.
Oh,
let's
God.
Talk about it. I have been waiting 3 years to talk about this on the podcast.
Holy,
I'm very excited.
Shit.
Okay.
It is time, then.
First of all, I have to point out, Mulder first meets Marita in Hair Invoke. That's the first time he's met her.
At the very end.
And I think... And that would be in episode 1 of season 4. And we're now in season 8. I think it's very clear from the scene where he calls Scully and he says, I need you to get a number for me, a New York number, that this is the first time he's telling her about Marita.
Okay.
I guess.
I never thought about that, but yeah.
I guess
can see
maybe
what you're saying.
They could have discussed her before, but it seems like this is the first time he's even contacting Marita after Hair Invoke.
And I think you're right.
And he says, I need you to get me the number. And then we cut to her building. And so I assume he's asking Scully to get Marita's number, which is point number one I want to make. He is not hiding Marita as a contact from Scully, at least
this
point. It's possible he's been hiding her up to now. We know Mulder has hidden a lot of his contacts from Scully, and we've discussed this before, be it protection or protecting his sources or protecting Scully. Mm-hmm. He has all kinds of reasons. Marita is our first female informant, and she's an attractive female informant. And so all of our hackles are going up, and we're like, who is this woman, and why is he not there with Scully? Blah, blah, blah. So I get it. I get it. First of all, going into this scene, Jen, I need to say that I am not, like, inherently opposed to the idea of Mulder and Marita hooking up.
Oh, God.
I apologize. I'm not.
I so am.
I am not, but I have to say the reason that I don't like it is because I feel like if Mulder is doing this for information, that to me doesn't vibe with Mulder's character ethically.
Right.
So that is why I don't believe that anything happened in this scene. I just want to start off by saying that. But I do think that they have given us enough information for us to definitely wonder. They think that they're showing us that he didn't do anything, but they're actually not showing that at all. And I'm about to explain, if you want to hear me explain really quickly.
You're going to have to explain that.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
He gets to her address at 12:36. Okay?
Right, right.
We fade in to him sleeping in a chair. And we know when he wakes up in this chair, because they have their little conversation that lasts 3 minutes or whatever, that it's 3:12. He has been at her apartment for almost 3 hours. Okay?
Right, okay.
We know that he has been there for almost 3 hours, and he's fallen asleep in a chair, okay?
Right.
When else have we seen him fall asleep in a chair, Jen? Right after he fucked the vampire lady
in
three, okay?
three.
And I am not saying this is evidence. I am not. But I'm just pointing that out as a matter of debate, okay?
All right, okay.
He then... She comes in, still in her bathrobe. I mean, put some fucking clothes on, Marita. 3 hours? You haven't put your clothes on, okay?
Oh, she's not going to put her clothes on.
No. She comes in, and I got to say, the overall, like, sort of narrative language of this scene, even though they're not saying anything explicit or telling us anything, is it's kind of like a sexy vibe. And I know that Marita is always sort of that way. I get it. But I think there's something to be said about this sort of narrative language. And I have to say, it's here. So she comes in. She is very sort of, she watches him while he's sleeping, you know. And then she's like waking him up. And I apologize, Jen. I see your face and you're not enjoying this at all. But I'm trying to be as objective as possible. He wakes up. They have their whole conversation. She tells him all this stuff. And he's like, okay, I got it. Where's my phone? Where's my phone? Why is he looking for his phone, Jen? Where did his phone go? Why can't he find his phone? I'm wondering this. They make a point.
Is it because clothes he was
have
unclothed
come off?
At some point?
I don't
is that
know.
What you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting it. I'm just pointing it out. Why is that a thing he's saying? Who cares? Why are you looking for your phone? And then the way that he... looks at her when she's like, how much time do you have? And she walks into the other room. We know nothing happened here because of the clock mash cut, right? Because we mash cut and it's 3:15, you know. I would really hope that Mulder is not a 2-minute man. So let's just assume that nothing happened, okay?
Yes.
It's like they're trying so hard to point out over here. It's like a magician trick. It's like, look over here. Look, guys, look over here. Look it, he didn't do it. It's been 2 minutes. He didn't do it. That everyone ignores all of the other sort of evidence that points to perhaps something having happened before. And that's all I will say. I am not landing on a side either way, because as much as I'm not opposed to Mulder and Marita having a hookup because they're attracted to each other and they're attractive people who maybe want to hook up, great. I don't like the idea of him having sex with somebody for information. I don't think Mulder would do that. I don't think that's in character of Mulder to do that. And that is the end of my soapbox thesis statement on the Marita scene, and I am eager to hear your opinion.
All right. I'm just going to ask one question that I may regret asking, which is your perception Is it that the only reason that they would have had sex is for information? You don't think that there's any other implication in that scene?
I hope there isn't, is what I'm saying. I hope that if they did have sex in that 3-hour period that we know he was there, that it wasn't for information.
Right.
And that is why they make a big point of saying later that she's clearly making a proposition to him and he doesn't take it. That's not that's not to say that nothing happened before. I don't think it's important to the story. And if people want to believe it didn't happen, I'm not here to ruin that for you. But I am just like, why did they make these decisions? They're there. They're on my screen. I have to take them into account. You know, we have him arriving at 12:36. We have her getting the information at 3:12. 3 hours have passed. He has fallen asleep. What happened in those 3 hours? That's what I'm asking. That's what I'm asking.
Fair enough. Fair points. I heartily disagree with your take on it, although I mean, it's a legitimate take. I'm not going to, I certainly see where it's coming from, and I'm certainly not going to say there's no way, that's not at all, because, I mean, you're right. The whole scene is presented in such a sexified way that we have to take something from that.
Right.
It's just so ridiculously over the top that I can hardly bear it, because, I mean, Marita is so like, oh, cover credentials, a diplomatic passport.
Well, I know you hate
visa.
Her anyways.
I mean, she delivers a line like that as though she's offering him a lot more than just a visa. I mean, it's just like,
well,
why?
She is. She's offering her sexy body, Jen.
She's definitely offering her sexy body. And this is why my argument is going to be they did not have sex, because she is still trying to seduce him the whole fucking time. And so I draw
she
from
wants
that.
She wants another go around, Jen.
I don't
who wouldn't?
Know. I think, I
who
think
wouldn't?
She's just thirsty. She's still thirsty for it because she's had nothing to drink. So that's the way.
Okay. And that's
I
absolutely
that.
Fair. That's absolutely
because
fair. And I actually want to believe that. I want
please,
to believe
it.
But these are these things that just, they gnaw at me, Jen.
I understand. I mean, I wouldn't want to feel that way, but I can see why you do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely clinging to my belief. And to me, it feels accurate that people are not that flirty, generally speaking, after they've had sex. And so the fact that she's still like laying it all on there with her, like, you know, she's just kind of sauntering around, swinging her hips with her sexy little stupid voice and her sexy little robe. She's still trying to seduce him, I think,
at
that point.
She just wants a round two on that spooky dick, Jen. I mean,
no,
look.
I mean, the three hours is a long time. I agree with that, which is why he fell asleep. He was so disinterested.
It was a long time, and that's why he fell asleep.
It was because it was so long. He got bored because she is nothing to him. And so he fell asleep because he was not even interested in her sexiness. And so he was bored. He fell asleep. She just took a long time to establish these details, I guess, which is unusually realistic for the X-Files to establish that it would take 3 hours to find this information. I do agree
again,
with that.
Again, it's just the language of the scene. I have to take into account what I'm meant to feel from this scene, not just what's happening, but what I am meant to feel from this scene. And it's just the way that it is acted, the way that it is presented to us if they didn't want to imply that this happened or could have happened, they wouldn't have done the scene this way. He could have met her anywhere. He could have met her at work. He could have met her at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial like he did before or like he will again. But they didn't. They had him meeting her in her apartment, in her robe, in her sexy voice. And it was just, it's a lot to think about. And again, don't know what to think. This is not like the Ed Gerst situation. Like, I have not landed on one side of this argument. The only reason I kind of want to believe it didn't happen is because I feel like the only reason it would happen is for him to get information. Like, I don't. But at the same time, I feel like that's unfair. Mulder's a guy and she's a hot woman, and maybe he's like, hey, let's do it. Why not? I mean, I can't judge. Like, maybe. And I don't know. I don't know. 3 hours?
I think
she's still in her bathrobe. It's.
The 3 hours to me is a little problematic, a tiny bit, but I can live with it. The general air of sexiness, I don't actually have a problem with. I think it, to me, the narrative purpose of that is not to demonstrate that they likely had sex or even wanted to, but that Marita wanted it, that she's very into Mulder. She's being deliberately seductive towards mm-hmm. him, and it helps to explain her motivation for helping him, because there really isn't a lot of other clear indication about why she would help him. I mean, she says something like, you know, there's those of us that believe in your cause.
And this,
but I don't believe that for a second.
No, and this leads me into my next.
She only believes in his hotness.
Yeah, well, we all do. That's all.
Yes.
Fair.
We all believe in Mulder's hotness.
This leads me into my next question is, do we think at this point Marita is in on it with Krycek? Because we know that Marita and Krycek are in it together in season 5. We see evidence of that yes, they are in on the plan, even though she's kind of taking him, she's manipulating him too. They're clearly working together at one point. And it seems like, okay, she's on the phone for several hours. Krycek is well aware that Mulder's headed to Russia. Like, was this all part of the plan? You know, it just, it feels very, very set up. And I mean, the whole purpose of this two-parter is that Krycek has pulled one over on Mulder. And I just wonder if Marita was a pawn in this plan, which is possible. And even,
I think, yeah,
even Krycek being like, what are you doing up there? Well, what was it? You know, I don't know. It just, it feels to me like it was all sort of set up, which I can buy.
I think I hadn't actually not thought of that before, but I think that's actually a really good point. And that is why Mulder had to be asleep during that scene, so he wouldn't overhear Marita and not suspect her, because at that point we need Mulder to trust her implicitly. Mm-hmm. And so the 3 hours was her getting up to all kinds of mischief with who knows whom. And that's why they had Mulder fall asleep, not because he was satiated after being sexually satisfied, but because we needed Mulder to kind of not have any reason to suspect her or to overhear any little tidbits or to even be aware of how much time has passed and be suspicious. That's why they had him fall asleep, because she's up to mischief. And she's trying to be seductive towards him to throw him off the scent, which in my opinion doesn't work at all, because I get no sense that Mulder's interested in her at all. She's like laying it out so obviously, and I really don't get the sense that he is picking up what she's putting down. And that whole, you know, it's 3:12, now it's 3:15. It's so clearly established that, hey, nothing happened between them. I don't see why they would do that if we were supposed to be left with any possible interpretation that they did have sex earlier, but they didn't have sex a second time. Why go to the trouble of establishing that if not to establish they didn't have sex at all?
Just to say, just to put this out there.
Okay. Okay.
Because like we were discussing before, maybe Mulder will get it on because Mulder feels like getting it on, but he won't do it for information.
Right.
Which is
a
distinction.
It's the timing of it.
It's such an important distinction in my mind to make.
Right.
That it's important to have pointed it out. And again, this is all just my interpretation. I don't even know how I interpret it. I am just laying out the facts, and I know we're going to get a lot of tweets about this. I'm very, very curious to hear what y'all think about this, but that 3 hours, man, I don't know why they would do it. I can't think of a reason.
I really like the idea now that it was just to give Marita more time to get up to all kinds of hijinks without Mulder knowing she was doing it. I'm going to go with that. It's just so that in retrospect, we can look at this and say, even then, Marita, up to mischief, because what was she doing for that 3 hours?
But I feel like
Mulder didn't even know.
I feel like they could have accomplished that in a different way. But anyway, it's okay.
I mean, the 3 hours is the one thing that I'll agree with you is a little hard to hand wave away, but it's not enough for me to say, oh, yes, they had sex, mainly because I just feel like Marita is really just pouring it on so strong the whole time, and Mulder really doesn't seem interested.
I think, to your point, Marita pours it on strong 100% of the time with literally everyone she's in contact with. So I can't really make a distinction. But to be clear, I am not defending this position. I am not sitting here saying you're wrong, I'm right, that I think this happened. I don't know what happened. I am just here to point out the facts. Why were these put into the show? Why was it laid out this way? And I think it led to some very interesting discussion, Jen.
I think it did too.
I still don't know where I land. I am not on a side for the what happened on this scene, because as in true X-Files fashion, I have walked away from this scene not knowing what the fuck happened. And we never will, maybe. So
I feel very confident on the side that I'm on.
Well,
that's
wonderful.
Nothing happened. I feel, and I remember like going through this. I went through this, the steps of my believing and disbelieving of what happened back in 1996. Because I remember this was a conversation online back then, like repeatedly.
I can imagine. Very much like how we talked about The Field Where I Died, being in the midst of it, in the thick of it, when you don't know what's happening with Mulder and Scully and you don't know where it goes, being very, very determined to be on that side.
I remember just being so distressed about the whole situation, and then the 312 and 315 thing, and I saw that and I was like, oh, thank God they didn't have sex. And it was just, I was very attached to that position and always will be.
Okay, and that's fair. I'm just saying, the luxury of hindsight that I have coming into the show much later, I don't really care what Mulder does with himself before he and Mulder are, he and Scully are a couple. So it doesn't bother me if it happened. It would only bother me if he did it for information, as I said before. That bothers me as a Mulder character thing. But anyway, it's fair really points. Not important to the plot. It's just a very interesting, intriguing moment that I think
it's very
is
interesting
worthy
to
of
me.
Conversation.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. I'll never get over it.
Like, I can see that, but hopefully you'll get over it. Let's move on.
Yes.
Speaking of wonderful ships that everyone loves that aren't Mulder and Scully, let's talk about Scully and Pendril.
Yay!
So
something I can get on board with.
Yeah, I love Pendril in this scene. I mean, I just love how every time he's with Scully, he's just so respectful. He's so, like, he trusts her judgment on everything. I love them in the suits. It's great.
Yeah.
Pendril's
a little worried, though, right? He's kind of like...
Because she's awfully sure.
We're in the same suit that he had.
Yeah, she's real sure that those suits are safe.
That's really like, oh, there's no way it came in through the suit.
Yeah,
but
I don't know about
that's
that.
Exactly what actually did happen.
Yeah,
when I watched the episode a second time today, and like after last night, and I was like, yep, no, it really did get in through the suit.
Yeah, so why was she... so sure. It bothers me a little bit.
Misplaced confidence, I think. Yeah, it's kind of like she's just it's just science. It's like there's no way things can get into this suit. Science tells me this. Mm-hmm. And obviously the black oil has magical powers that Scully has never encountered, but
that's
she doesn't believe this anyway.
They weren't there when this happened, so as long as as far as she knew, he took his suit off, stuck the black oil in it, and then shut the suit and was like, let's have a party. Like, I don't know. I don't know what she was thinking.
Or that there was a rip in the suit that they couldn't see or something like that.
That's true.
She's just, you know, she has to rely on, you know, facts and science, and she's probably very used to, you know, wearing these kind of suits in very dangerous situations, and she has to have confidence in her equipment, and she does.
Yeah.
It's just really misplaced confidence in this case.
Yeah, yeah. This scene is really kind of creepy, and I think it's really well done. I like how the guy kind of jerks awake, and she's like, I do think it's funny when she's like, this man is alive, and I'm like, do you think so? No, I wanted to be like, oh geez, but it's true, because
it
is
kind of funny, actually.
It is a medical mystery, because
it is a medical mystery.
How can he be alive? And I think we still don't know what happened to that guy.
No, that's kind of I realized.
We find out in Terma. We do find out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Does he come back in Terma? Because I was trying to remember. Do we ever actually know?
I'm pretty sure that
I will recall when I rewatched Terma.
Yeah, we'll get to it. But I'm pretty sure that Vasilky guy, that Russian guy, like, injects him with the vaccine and, like, saves him.
Oh, yeah. And that's coming back to me.
That'll be coming back. But within
Tunguska, we don't get closure on what happened to him.
We don't know what happened.
So it's all left out there as a mystery.
Poor doctor. That's Dr. Sachs, right?
Dr. Sachs.
What is
Dr. Sachs, who was so nice and so knowledgeable and really keen to cut into that rock, and oh dear, it went really badly. The black oil is so very scary in this episode, though. They did a fabulous job with the effects.
Oh yeah, they did a great job. I mean, particularly at the end, but we'll get to that. I also wanted to point out, I love when he says he's so excited. I love people who just love their work so much. He's like, but we won't know until we cut into the rock, which I very much wish you'll allow me to do. Like, he's so excited. I love it. I just love it.
And it winds up being a really bad thing, but
I
he's
know,
so sweet how excited he is.
He is. So Okay, Krychek and Mulder are on their way to Russia, which again is another part of Krychek's plan, because he clearly is yelling at Mulder in Russian so that Mulder will bring him.
Yeah,
what a brilliant
plan.
A bit
of a, it's kind of a long shot at that point. It seems like Mulder could easily have missed that and kept on walking, which does make me wonder, what was Mulder's idea at that point? Was he genuinely going to leave Krychek behind in the car?
I think Krychek, for some reason, knew that Mulder would bring him. And I think Mulder was fucking with him. This could be wrong, but I kind of like to think that Mulder was just fucking with him.
And he was going to go back and get him no matter what you figured.
And he was going to take him, but I think then the fact that Krychek is speaking in Russian, Mulder was like, okay, well, I can use this. This is very useful to me.
This will be fun.
But who knows? It is a good question. Yeah. Was he going to just leave him there? He did survive in a silo for God knows how long. So
he did, and we don't need to know exactly the details of how that happened. Apparently,
no one's gonna tell us
that. But I do like the interpretation that you have that Mulder was just kind of screwing with him and was going to come back and get him, because at the time it really didn't look like that. And I was like, well, that. I mean, I presume he could have called Scully to come and get him, but that still seems pretty mean.
Yeah.
But you know, this is all part of the mentally beating up on Krychek, in addition to the physically beating up on Krychek that goes on throughout this episode. So it's just in keeping with the whole theme.
It is. Another angel is getting its wings. Enjoy it. So we have a lovely, well manicured man scene. We always love when well manicured man shows up.
I just
love how it's like every time we cut to well manicured man, he's just having he's just living his best life. He's just enjoying the countryside. There's horses running around.
There's always horses.
He's playing with his grandchildren and they're playing cricket in the yard. And he's having some tea and everything is lovely. And then Smoking Man shows up to fuck up his life.
Yeah. I love the fact that CSM had to come and see him in person. And they did kind of explain that in the narrative.
I like that. You know,
there's no phones out there.
He's like, I do that on purpose, bitch. Take the hitch.
But how much would we have lost if we didn't get to see that conversation in person? And it really wouldn't have made any sense why he had to be there in person unless they explained it. So I appreciate that. Appreciate that they actually did have to have the conversation together, because love well-manicured man. I love CSM and I love them together.
Love them together.
It was a classic scene between the two of them.
It really was. And I do, again, this is another sort of an old techie alert, we couldn't have a scene like this now, because they would have a way to communicate. They would have a phone I don't have a phone, but and I suppose we could have gotten away with, I don't have an email, I don't have anything, you have to drive up all the way up here to talk to me. But I feel like that's the kind of scene maybe we couldn't have gotten away with nowadays.
True, it is more of a 90s thing, isn't it?
Yeah, which I enjoy. I like it. Well manicured man, as always, seems very irritated that Mulder knows about this.
He's appalled.
He's always appalled, and I think appalled well manicured man is the best of well manicured man.
It's so often how he is. Like he's got two gears. One is sort of placid happiness in the country, and then appalled. Those are his two gears.
But
and
I CSM love both gears. I love
both gears.
He's so good. I just love him.
I love it when he says to CSM, "You fool, you stupid fool." It's just it's so beautifully WMM that I love it. This must be corrected. It must be handled. Everything is just so perfectly written and perfectly delivered by John Neville, whom I adore. So they're so great together, and they're just both being the best of their characters in that scene. It's just great acting on both of their parts.
Right. I kind of wanted to get into that scene a little bit, but it's kind of more of the same. We kind of just get more of which is always wonderful, but it's more of hey, I don't like Will Manicured Man saying, I don't like the way you handle this. Your method of handling this is just to kill everyone, which is always CSM's implication. And I did like his line, Will Manicured Man's line of, this is going to take more than a good aim. Because he's so condescending in a good way to Smoking Man, kind of this is all you can do. You're worthless. You hire these jackasses to make botched assassination attempts. You're worthless. I feel like if Well Manicured Man could, he would fire Smoking Man. Like, that is their relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, like, Well Manicured Man isn't wrong.
No.
I mean, he's got good history on his side to reinforce his argument.
Yeah.
CSM's kind of a bungling murderer.
Yeah.
And it's fair enough. Fair point. And yeah, I think that it's not, we don't learn a whole lot, but it does establish that these guys know what Mulder's up to. So I
right.
think that's probably the main point.
And I think it's like, I don't know why, but I'm thinking of this. What is the, is it when it's something in the revival when Mulder is talking about, he's posing as someone else. Oh, no, it's Dreamland. Sorry, that was quite a journey my brain took. When he's like talking about himself and he's like, Agent Mulder had to go blah, 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 blah. You know, like he's like very irritated with himself. And I feel like that is constantly Well Manicured Man's attitude. It's always like, why is this guy still alive? Not that he wants to kill him, but it's just like, why is this guy keep popping up and ruining our plans? Like, I'm so annoyed with this Agent Mulder. Which I always
like,
just,
I am so over that guy.
Yeah. Where, I mean, he eventually obviously reaches the breaking point where he's like, well, this guy's not going away, so I guess I'm going to have to use him to find my way out of all of this.
Yeah. Can't beat him, join him.
Exactly. Which I kind of enjoy. Yep. It's kind of nice.
I love it.
Well, Manicured Man has a really cool arc, and I really like him.
He's the best.
He really is. So here we are back in Tunguska, where we have Mulder and Krycek getting caught. And this is the scene where Mulder is literally, I should say, David Duchovny is outrunning horses. And I know this is quite well known in fandom lore that he is a very fast runner, that he can outrun horses. They had to redo these scenes, I think, over and over because he just kept running too fast.
It was taking too long to get caught.
Yeah.
I love watching David Duchovny run. It's a beautiful thing to watch.
It is a beautiful thing. And I enjoy it, especially with horses. Really? I'm assuming that they filmed this in Vancouver somewhere, but it's very, it's very convincingly a Siberian forest. I'll take it.
It looks very much like a BC forest to me, but I mean, I can definitely believe that's in Russia. I don't know what Russia looks like. A forest is a forest.
Exactly.
It's beautiful and misty, and it's all the things I love about anything shot in BC.
Yeah. Love it. I also wanted to give Mark Snow a shout out because I think the music in particular in this episode is very good, especially this prison scene where Mulder's talking to this prisoner. I think the music is so eerie and it's unsettling and just very, very well done. Bravo, Mark Snow.
Yeah.
Again, it's another, like,
fantastic.
I know we talked about this last time with Wetwired. He always has these very sort of specific motifs that I think he keeps to certain storylines and certain episodes even. And I feel like this is very, when I hear that, it's very much instantly Tunguska Terma. And I think it's wonderful. It's beautiful.
He just brings out the genius for every episode and just establishes perfect tone every time.
So good. I want to give a shout out to the actor who plays the prisoner. His name is Stefan Arngrim. And I looked at his IMDb, and he has been quite a prolific actor.
Really?
Ever since he was a child, it looks like.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's funny because I have no clue who this guy was, but I always kind of love him in this episode. I think he's very intriguing, and I like watching him, and I like listening
it
to him.
Is. And it, yeah, he always, it's a... He does a great job with his eyes and his voice. That's all we get of him, but he does an amazing job with those.
Yeah, his eyes totally also look like Johnny Depp, too. I don't know why, but I always kind of am like, oh, he looks like Johnny Depp. So I just picture that he's really hot behind that wall. I don't know what he looks like, but let's just go with that.
I could believe that he'd be hot,
because if he's stuck in a gulag, at the very least, the guy could be hot, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's give him that. Okay.
Yeah, let's give him that,
Since we never see his face and we don't know, let's give him that.
Yeah.
So I had to give him a shout out. Stefan Arngrim. Very good,
good job.
Yeah, so I like their conversation. I like how sort of resigned he is. But then later when he's talking about sort of the persistence of life, I think all of that is so good. I think this is so good. And it's really good for Mulder to hear. Especially when, you know, a lot of the time we'll get sort of nihilistic Mulder, or like, I have seen too much shit, like, you know, Profiler Mulder, I'm thinking of, and he sees so much bad stuff in this world that it's nice for him to hear about the persistence of life. It's sort of a positive message in this terrible, terrible situation.
Yeah.
Just want to point that out. I like their whole exchange. I think it's good. And I think it's really good in Terma. I might even be quoting Terma. Sorry if I'm getting ahead of myself.
It's okay. They blend together.
They do blend together.
But it's very well-written dialogue.
I wanted to point out some of the technical aspects of this for, you know, mythology okay. reasons. So mm-hmm. this doctor, who we mm-hmm. see again, I believe, I think we see him again later in next season too, actually. He shows up, I mm-hmm. believe, again. Injects Mulder into the neck, into the yep. back of the neck, this spot they love on this show, with this yes. vaccine, right?
Yes.
And then he's put into this chicken wire and exposed to the black oil, right?
Yes, yes.
This scene happens so quickly that it always makes me remember, you know, like a lot of people, and we talk about this all the time, talk about how much torture Scully was put through. Like, y'all, yeah. Mulder was put through a lot of shit on this show. Yeah. This is, I think, in particular, one of the worst things I can imagine. It preys on every single one of your fears. You're claustrophobic. You're being completely tied down by chicken wire. You're in the dark. You're naked. You're being forced. This stuff is being forced onto your face, ugh. Into your nose, into your mouth while you're screaming. You're hearing all these other people around you being subject. Like, this is awful, awful shit. And he's awake for all of this. Like, it's horrible.
Yeah, it is just pure horror.
Yes, and it's so good. It's a great scene. It's terrifying. And I wanted to talk again about the technical, because I know we talked before, and we will talk again next episode about the whole idea with the smallpox and the arm getting chopped off or whatever. But there's a fresh wound on Mulder's arm I'm wondering, what do you think is going on? Like, are they biopsying his smallpox scar?
That's a really good question. I was going to ask you that question. Because it definitely, the camera lingers slightly on it. There does seem to be a point. It is in the same place as where the smallpox scar would be. Mm-hmm. So there were to make something of that. Trying to remember if we get more out of that in Terma. Maybe I'll have theory then.
I remember more than anything else, I feel like it's sort of a mark, like a signifier. Like, this person has been tested. We want to test them again. And so the people who don't want to be tested again will chop the arm off so that there is no signifier there. But it doesn't make sense, because you feel like you see people walking around with no arm. Then you're like, oh, that's probably one of our guys. Let's get him. So I
think there must be something. There's something in the smallpox scar that they need for the experiment.
Right. But that's guessing. Like a biopsy
I think we get more of that in Terma, but that's kind of. That's how I took it, that they're taking something out of your smallpox scar of what was put into you when you received your smallpox vaccine.
Yeah, like if you don't have one to biopsy, then you're useless to them.
That's exactly.
Kind of the
That's
idea.
That's the way I take that, but we'll have to see how it pans out in terms.
Yeah, yeah. It's the whole idea of it is really sort of, you know, creepy body horror type stuff that I
Absolutely.
Think is very effective. I just wish it was more clear. What was
it's
going
a little
on.
Muddy. It's one of those things. It's like I can kind of imagine that, like, you know, Chris Carter or Frank Spotnitz just kind of sitting around saying, hey, this is like a cool visual or a cool concept. Let's not worry about the details, but let's just put it in there.
Yeah. But I mean, just it does. And if it weren't so closely tied into all of the things we've already learned about the smallpox vaccine and all those things. It probably wouldn't bother me, but because it is so closely tied that I really kind of want to make sense of it. So,
If
anyone
too,
can sort of succinctly explain this, I feel like we talked about it before and I've already forgotten. Please text us or text us. Text us. Text me, guys. Tweet at us at XXD Podcast. Let us know what your take is on all of this, because it's still one of those things that I can't quite wrap my brain around.
And I do have it's one of those elements of the mythology that I find quite interesting, the smallpox scar, because that is something that comes up frequently throughout the mythology. And I do like anything that has an element of continuity to it. And, you know, it goes back to like Paperclip, which is, you know, one of my favorites. And also because I have a smallpox scar. And so it's just kind of like, oh, my God, they're talking about me. It's horrifying. So. We'll talk about this again, I think, when we're talking about Terma, but I'm very into that aspect of it and would like to understand it better too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, other than I wanted to talk about what you think the Russian involvement is here, other than the fact that, like, I really like just the whole idea of the Cold War is still going on. And of course they're trying to one up us. Like, I mean, I think the whole over the next couple seasons is that like the Russians are in a race mm-hmm. to develop this vaccine. And clearly they have won because this vaccine works. Mm-hmm. Mulder obviously does not succumb to the black mm-hmm. oil, and he is forever, for the rest of this series, has this vaccine in him, which I think is something, again, very easy to forget in a 2 second scene. Literally takes to remember that he was injected with this vaccine. Mm-hmm. Scully also, in Fight the Future, injected with this vaccine. So mm-hmm. they are both permanently altered. And it's so easy to forget these things, I think.
Yeah. It's because it's a very key point, but it is very quick.
And then we're never reminded of it again.
We're not. And when you're watching the episode, I always assumed when I was watching the episode when they're shooting him with that needle right before he's in his torture spot, that they're just like, it's a needle to knock him out
right.
or to kind of paralyze him or whatever. That would make the most sense. And so sometimes it's hard to remember to look back on it and say, oh, no, that was actually the vaccine.
Yeah.
So it's not like it was a moment that stood out at the time as being significant. It just seemed like it was just, you know, part of what you normally expect when you're being attacked.
Right. And I actually don't even think the word vaccine is brought into this until later.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think I could be wrong because I know at some point they talk about how Bill Mulder, that was his whole thing, is that he was working on the vaccine.
Right.
But that might not even have come up until later. I know that's a big deal in Fight the Future, and I know mm-hmm. obviously it's a big deal like later, but I feel like we are at this point left to sort of speculate.
Yeah, definitely at this point, it's definitely, certainly within Tunguska, it's definitely a mystery. I'll have to see whether how much we learn in Terma about it, but it is a significant point.
The prisoner does say that, actually. I think he does say he thinks they're testing a vaccine or a cure.
Yeah.
He uses the word cure.
Cure, yeah.
So not specifically vaccine, but he does use the word cure. Meanwhile, hey everyone, PSA, get vaccinated. I'm putting it out there. Everybody get vaccinated. Don't listen to fictional tales of vaccination on the X-Files.
No.
Take your butt down and get vaccinated.
Vaccines are actually really good. I mean, I have my scar from the smallpox vaccine, and look, I'm fine and not being tracked by the government at all. So mm-hmm. even the most suspicious of vaccines are actually really benign and helpful, because I never had smallpox either, which
is
really great.
Look, isn't it funny the way that works, Jen?
It's a wonderful thing. Really, really came together really well for me. And everyone in my generation, we managed to get rid of, we eradicated smallpox. That's what science does for us. That's what vaccines do for us. That's what vaccines are still doing for us. Get your 2 vaccines. Don't be like Mulder. He just needed the 1 vaccine. We need 2. Get both of them.
Yeah.
And it's an insult to Scully and to science if you don't.
It really is. That's actually a really, really good thing to say. And this is a perfect episode to actually say it. We're going to say officially, go get vaccinated, folks. And I think on that note, that's a great place to end this episode, Jen.
It really is.
What do you think?
I think that's great. Yeah, I think that's absolutely. It's news you can use, and also lots of X-Files talk. That's what we're here for on X-Files Diaries.
And Scully approves.
She demands it.
Demands it, guys. Demands it.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for listening, and we will be back with you for the remainder of this wonderful tale with Terma in a couple weeks in our mythology series. But thanks for listening, and we will be back with you soon on X-Files Diaries. Bye.
Bye.